Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Do animals have emotions and an emotional life? Well, if you ask any pet owner or person around animals, they would say, of course. But the scientific community has always believed there was a fundamental distinction between the emotional life of humans and other species. This view has been challenged by animal behavior psychologists and confirmed, more recently, by neuroscience. My guest today has been in the forefront of that movement. Franz de Waal is a professor of psychology at Emory University and the director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center in Georgia. He's been witnessing chimpanzee, bonobo, monkey, and other species' behaviors for decades, both in the wild and captivity. And over that time, he's witnessed apes reconciling after conflict, showing gratitude, happiness, humor, grief, empathy, and altruism. His new book shares these stories, as well as the story of Mama, a 59-year-old chimpanzee matriarch whose last encounter with her caretaker contributes to the title of his latest book, Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. It's published by Norton. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Professor de Waal, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Your book, Mama's Last Hug, comes from a viral video about Mama, a matriarchal chimpanzee at the Arnhem Zoo, her end-of-life encounter with one of your colleagues who had been involved in her life, studied her for decades, Jan van Hoff. And it seems to be an easy-to-understand moment for all scientific doubters that animals have emotions. Why is this viral video so important?
Well, I think people were extremely touched by it because it's a very emotional scene where she is dying. She's 59 and Jan van Hoff, the professor, is 80. And so he's meeting her in her bedroom, which normally we would never go in with an adult chimpanzee, but since she was dying and since he knew her so well, he went in. And I think everyone was touched by it. I was very touched by it. But what really got me is that people were so surprised by how human-like the expression was on Mama's face and her vocalizations and her gestures. She embraced him and calmed him down, probably sensing that he was a bit nervous entering her bedroom. And so people were so surprised by the human-like gestures and facial expressions. And that is something that surprised me. I thought, everyone knows that chimpanzees are our closest relatives, so why would people be surprised that she expresses very similar emotions to the ones that we have? And so that's why I took it as the starting point to explain about facial expressions. The primates have very much the same facial expressions as we do. They stare at each other when they're angry. They pout when they're disappointed. And so there's really not much new in our face. There was a time where we thought that the human face had many more muscles than any other primate, but after people have analyzed the faces of multiple primates, we don't think that anymore. We have basically the same number of muscles in the face.
You know, I think you're looking at the scientific side, but I think when most viewers would view this video as I did, you're struck by how human this encounter seemed. I mean, how many people mm-hmm. have had similar end-of-life moments with family members, and the expressions were exactly the same. I think this gets mm-hmm. to an idea that I think you write about in the book, is that, you know, for people who have been around animals, most pet owners, they would say this is a no-brainer. Of course animals have emotions. We see them in the course of family pets, even farm animals. So why has there been such reluctance to embrace this idea within the scientific community?
You wonder, because we've had a century of the behaviorists, as we call them, the Skinnerians, who said you should never, and that's why they were called behaviorists, you should focus on behavior. You should never assume inner states like intelligence or cognition or feelings or emotions. You stay away from those. You just talk about the exterior and the behavior. And they applied that rule also actually to human behavior. For the longest time, they felt we should not talk about human thinking or human feelings. And so that school dominated in the previous century, even though many people who have pets at home, like dogs and cats, they have no trouble assuming emotions in their animals. So there was really a discrepancy between the general public and the scientists. And I grew up as a student with all these instructions, never talk about emotions, don't use anthropomorphic terminology. So, for example, at some point I discovered that chimpanzees reconcile after fights, they kiss and embrace after a fight. And I wanted to call that reconciliation, but people would say, no, you have to call that post-conflict contact. So they wanted me to stay away from human terminology, and which all that it does is really create distance between us and other species that is really unnecessary and I think from a biological perspective, inappropriate.
Do you think there's also a theological element?
Yeah, I think religion plays a role. Even though the scale of nature and the special position of humans goes back to the Greeks, so it goes back to before Christianity. So I think it's a sort of mixture between the influence of the ancient Greeks and Christianity, which embraced that only we have souls and animals don't have souls, and so they also embraced that kind of separation. We have this tendency to set ourselves apart. I call it anthropodenial. It's like the opposite of anthropomorphism. Is we are in denial about the connection between us and other species. And I personally think anthropodenial is actually more of a problem than anthropomorphism because it has an additional element. If you disconnect yourself from nature and you see yourself as basically your own invention and your mind is different from all animal minds, so to speak, you also set yourself apart from the ecology around you. And I think our current ecological disasters that we have, like the mass extinction of animals, the global warming, and so on, is also a product of that. It's a product of us thinking that we are different from nature and we're separate from nature. And I think it's in the end, it's a destructive attitude that is that cannot be maintained in the modern world.
When did you first come to a scientific understanding that animals do have emotions?
Well, I think all my life I've worked basically on emotions without using the word. So I worked on conflict resolution and reconciliation, cooperation, empathy, all sorts of things that involve the emotions. But we were not allowed to use this kind of terminology, and so we described just the behavior, or we gave it some sort of neutral term. And in this book, I decided I'm going to throw that all out, and I'm just going to talk about what I think is going on, which I really think is that the emotions are extremely similar to our emotions.
In all manners? In all different types?
Well, if you move away from the primates and the mammals, and you get to, let's say, lizards and fish and octopus, who knows? I don't know what's going on with those species. I find them much harder to read. I'm going to assume that they have emotional states because we have indications that they have states of fear and aggression and so on. So I do assume emotions in them, but I find them much harder to read. And so, for example, a chimpanzee, since they're so close to us, they have the same hands and the same arms and the same gestures and the same facial expression. So that's very easy to read. And I'm going to assume also that probably the feelings associated with the emotions are also similar, even though the feelings, which are internal states, are very hard to know for me. So that's a guess. I just guess that since they're so close to us and they express their emotions so similarly, they must have similar feelings too. But if you go to an animal like a fish or an elephant for that matter, that's much harder to judge these things.
Of course, there are equally viral videos of animal behaviors involving elephants, involving herding animals, in which they don't react the way I think a lot of scientists would expect them to act. Say, the herd taking over the mothering instinct for an individual cow in a herd when they're threatened by a predator, or yeah, even going to extraordinary lives to endanger their own lives to help a calf that's not their own. So in a wide range of animals, there are videos now that show that emotions of something beyond instincts is at play in animal lives.
Yeah, so for example, the most striking ones at the moment are these videos that we have of whales helping seals against orcas, for example. So the humpback whales, a seal is attacked by an orca or several orcas, and the humpback whales is going to defend the seal. So that's between species. That doesn't make any sense for the biologist because that humpback whales care about their own young, that is completely understandable, but why would they care about a seal? And so we were very puzzled by these cases, but I think it is based on the same mechanism in the sense that they help distressed individuals, and I think that's a very old mammalian tendency, and so they may apply that even across species.
You've had studies of chimps in captivity where, you know, we think of food being an incredible motivator for animal behavior, in which chimps, where they cannot receive food, but they can use a tool to give food to others, will do so, and their only satisfaction is the satisfaction of seeing other chimps eat.
Yeah. So about 10, 15 years ago, the storyline on animals was that, yes, humans care about the well-being of others. Humans will do things for others even if they get nothing for it. But that's a uniquely human feature. And everyone believed that. There were a few experiments that sort of supported that. But now we have a ton of experience. So, for example, there's one experiment that was done with bonobos where a bonobo gets a whole pile of fruit and can eat all the fruit by himself. But he has also learned that there's a door, and he has learned how to open the door, and that behind that door sits another bonobo. And what the bonobo usually does in the experiment is first open that door, let the other one in, and then share the whole pile of fruit with the other one. So he's losing basically half the fruit to his partner. So that kind of experiment has now been done with, I think, with apes, but also with some other species like dogs and rats. And the whole story of that we are the only ones who care about the well-being of others, that is now out of the window because we have too many indications that all the mammals, I'm not sure that this works the same way with birds or other species, but certainly all the mammals have this tendency of helping each other, especially individuals that they know.
Yeah. An important story in your own understanding came from another female chimp from the same colony that Mama came from, a Koof. And Koof, yeah, and Mama were very, very close, and you got close to Mama as well. And Koof was sort of a different story. Koof kind of resented the fact that you were, Mama accepted you, and she was liable to act out with you for some time. But then all of a sudden an important event happened that helped your own understanding, but also changed your relationship with Koof.
Yeah, so she, like all chimpanzees, basically all chimpanzees, they try to get the upper hand. They like to be dominant, you know. And so, and males have that more than females, but Kuif, we call her Kuif. Kuif was a female who did that to me and tried to be dominant over me, which was not always nice. But she was a good friend of Mama, and she was always together with her, and so I always dealt with them together. Mama never did these kind of things to me. She was always sort of very friendly to me. So Kuif had several babies that she lost. And she lost them because she didn't have enough milk production. And this was always terrible to see because she would have then that baby. We would be happy for her, but the baby would shrivel away and die. And she would go into a deep depression and sit in the corner and scream. She would not eat for weeks on end. It was always a terrible scene. And at some point we decided we need to either sterilize or we need to do something so that this doesn't happen again. But then at that same time, we got another baby chimp that was available that was up for adoption because the mother couldn't take care of it. So we had all of a sudden a baby chimp that we could offer to her, and I decided to teach her how to bottle feed. This was actually quite simple because chimpanzees are tool users, and so holding a bottle and feeding a baby is really no big deal for them. So we held the baby back for quite a while, for 6 weeks, I believe. And I would show her how to bottle feed, and I would show her, and I would sometimes give the bottle to her through the bar so that she could feed the baby also. And then after 6 weeks, we put the baby in the straw of her night cage to see if she would adopt it. Now, the thing that happened, that we had not expected that, we should have expected it, is that she did not want to touch the baby. And I think that is because she considered it my baby. And in chimpanzees, you don't just take anybody's baby. So she kept looking at the baby and looking at me, but she was unwilling to take it. And so we, the caretaker and me, we kept urging her, telling her to take the baby. And at some point, she picked it up. And from that moment on, she took care of it, and she did the bottle feeding. And she was very successful. so successful, in fact, that she also raised her own offspring, future offspring, she raised on the bottle. So she became a very successful mother. And that changed her attitude to me completely. So instead of being unfriendly to me on occasion as she was, now I was all of a sudden a family member. I was the best friend, human friend she had. And each time she saw me, she was extremely happy. And so that completely changed her attitude towards me.
I got the sense that it was almost gratitude in a way.
Yeah, we have quite a bit of evidence for gratitude, because we do studies on reciprocity. Like, if I do you a favor, will you do me a favor? And if you think about that kind of reciprocity, it is mediated by gratitude, because why would you do me a favor back unless you feel grateful for what you received from me? And so there's all sorts of evidence now in animals, especially in the primates, for reciprocity in helping behavior. And so I think gratitude is a perfectly fine emotion for animals to have who live in a system like that. And I also hear often from people who adopt animals, like you adopt a dog or a cat from the shelter, that there's also great gratitude there. And I think some of that may be interpretation. It's possible. We probably need to test this out more. But I've also adopted animals in the home, and I also felt always that they remained grateful for what happened to them.
I think I've done rescue animals a number of times, and I can't put my finger on it. I couldn't say it was anything scientific, but certainly I have the feeling that that animal is grateful to have escaped its previous condition of being abandoned, of being perhaps abused in a previous home. But there's nothing I can put my finger on, but boy, that's certainly my feeling,
something we can test out. You can do a study. I'm not going to do studies anymore. I'm getting too old for that. But you could do a study where you compare animals who have adopted from a shelter to animals that, who knows, they come from a breeder or something like that. Compare how different the attitudes are in the home. That would be an interesting study to do.
Yeah. My guest today is Franz Duval, a professor of psychology at Emory University and director of the Living Link Center at the YERCS National Primate Research Center. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. His new book is titled Mama's Last Hug: Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. It's a really interesting book into primate behavior, the emotions that play a role in their hierarchies and communities, a lot on what you find in these colonies is a lot of laughter, grinning, not only for social order, but good humor of chimpanzees within these colonies. I want to talk about some of the emotions that we very much associate with humans, though. And the two that came to my mind was shame and guilt. Mm-hmm. And you write in the book, disgust is something we really have traditionally thought as that is mainly a human emotion, but there are certainly animal behaviors that seem to manifest disgust. What about shame and guilt as well?
Well, guilt is interesting because there's so many dog owners who feel their dogs experience guilt when they have done something wrong. And there are scientists who have done experiments on dogs to test this out. So they create situations where the owner comes home and the dog has done absolutely nothing wrong, but there is a mess on the floor, and then see how the dog reacts. Or situations where the dog has done something wrong, but the owner doesn't know about it. And so they create these kind of scenarios. And the conclusion thus far of these studies has been that dogs anticipate punishment, so they know when they're in trouble, especially if the owner is angry at them, but they don't experience necessarily guilt. So before the owner comes home, they probably are not in trouble. But I'm not 100% convinced by these studies, because the thing that is missing, I think, is situations where the owner comes home and doesn't know anything. And because I've heard from many dog owners that you come home, you don't know anything that has happened, but you can see in the eyes of your dog that something has happened. Which means that they are already showing the signs of having done something wrong before you even have any knowledge of it. And so I don't think the experiments are complete, and so I'm not 100% convinced that dogs don't have guilt. But, you know, I would also say about human guilt that it is very often anticipation of punishment. So there's many people, many politicians, for example, they only apologize once they have gotten caught by something. And before that time, they never showed any signs of guilt. So how, I think in humans also, it is not perfectly internalized. And we have a lot of these responses that are very similar.
What about disgust? This was another emotion really thought to be the province of humans, but you have found many instances where animals will show disgust.
Yeah, disgust is actually a very simple one, I think, because disgust is related to you should not ingest food that is poisonous or contaminated. Of course, that's a very old problem and a very adaptive emotion to have. And so there's all sorts of indications. There's now finally also some experiments on primates. So some of the experiments, they place, for example, food on a piece of feces. Feces is one of the things you're going to be disgusted by. And so then you see if animals want to eat that food or what food they prefer, food that has been sitting on a piece of feces or food that is put next to it and has not touched it. And in all these studies, it's clear that the primates try to avoid contamination. And so they must have a disgust response. There's also, of course, many animals who have nests and keep their nests meticulously clean, which is also, I assume that they are disgusted by certain things that they find in their nest, such as the poop of their offspring or something like that. So there's all these indications. And in addition, on top of all that comes that the expression of disgust in the higher primates, like the chimpanzee, is very similar to ours. So if chimpanzees find something that they don't like, or all of a sudden it starts raining, which is also something they really don't like. They have these what I call rain faces, which looks exactly like the human disgust face. They bring the upper lip close to the nose, and they narrow the eyes, which is the human disgust face, which is basically a facial expression that tries to prevent wafts of foul air getting into your face. And they show that when it rains, and humans also show a disgust face sometimes when it rains. And so I think that's another thing, is the facial expression is very similar.
Well, you talked about how behaviorists sort of try to avoid any expression of emotions or within animal behavior and animal life. Where is that today? Has the scientific community come to agreement that emotions are a part of animals' lives?
Yeah, I think the taboo of the behaviorist has been broken partly by the neuroscientists. So the neuroscientists, they work on, let's say, fear in the rat and fear in the human. And the amygdala, part of the brain, is involved in the rat. We know that if we stimulate the amygdala in the rat becomes fearful. And we also know that if you put humans in a brain scanner and you present them with fearful things that make them afraid, scary images, the amygdala lights up in the brain scanner. And so since the part of the brain that is involved is very similar in the fear of the rat and the fear of the human, I think the neuroscientists have broken that taboo by saying these emotions must be extremely similar because the same parts of the brain are involved. So, for example, at Emory here we do studies of dogs. We put dogs in the brain scanner. You can train a dog to sit still in the brain scanner for a couple of minutes. And then they announce to them that they will get food. And then they see which part of the brain lights up if they think they're going to get food. And it's the same part in the brain that lights up as when you put a businessman in the brain scanner and you announce that he gets a big bonus. The same part of the brain. So the neuroscientists are breaking down these taboos by saying, well, the brain of a human and the brain of a dog react similarly to the announcement of rewards. And I think as a result, the whole behaviorist position that we shouldn't be talking about emotions or that they are not relevant or things like that is falling apart at the moment.
What are the big questions that are still out there in regard to animal intelligence and emotional intelligence that you feel are the next to be answered?
Well, I think certainly the feeling part. So that's something I don't know much about. I have a lot of assumptions about the feelings of animals, but I cannot put my finger on what's going on. And I think neuroscience may be able to help us with that and maybe help us with the inner experiences. And apart from that, I think since we only started now on the study of emotions in animals, there's an enormous amount of work to do, both in the field and in captivity, in experimental settings. And in the field, of course, the studies, that's a bit of a problem, is we're losing so much wildlife at the moment that studies in the field are really under pressure. There's a lot of apes, for example, disappearing at the moment. I don't know if you heard that, for example, 100,000 orangutans disappeared over the last 20 years in Borneo, in Indonesia, which is basically the half the population. So we have a big challenge to collect information on these species and maybe make people more aware of how valuable they are and how valuable their forests are.
Well, at the end of the book, you get into the whole idea of sentience, which is obviously still problematic, and it's something that's evolving. But I want to ask, how should all this knowledge that we're accumulating about animal emotions, about perhaps what they are feeling, their emotional intelligence, their actual intelligence, how should this knowledge change our relationship with animals?
Yeah, I think the sort of work that I do has moral implications in the sense that when animals were just machines, which was the previous attitude, so to speak, animals are dumb and they are machines and they don't feel, we could do anything we wanted with them. And maybe that was also partly the appeal of that position, is that it gave us an excuse to do whatever we wanted. And I think now we are living in a time where the science is really telling us that animals have experiences, they have maybe even consciousness, but they certainly have emotions. They have high levels of cognition sometimes. So that means that we cannot do anything we want with them. We have a moral obligation to take care of them and to respect them. And for me, that doesn't necessarily mean that we should stop eating meat. I'm too much of a biologist, and I believe in the circle of life. We see that all around us. So I'm not saying that we should stop eating meat, but definitely the animals that we do eat, we should treat better. We can do a much better job at how we treat them. And that may mean that we eat less meat. That would be fine with me. We need to eat less meat and treat the animals that we do eat a lot better.
Well, the book is really interesting, and your stories of following the colonies, both in Arnhem and as well as your own primate research center, are really interesting to read. The name of the book is Mama's Last Hug. Frans de Waal, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Frans de Waal is a professor of psychology at Emory University in Atlanta and the director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center, also in Georgia. His new book is titled Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. It's published by Norton. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.